Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insider's insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, is our behavior free will or parasites? New science show how parasites change behaviors throughout the animal kingdom. Then, one program seeking to heal and rebuild the lives of the tens of thousands of children victimized in the brutal wars of Uganda. Finally, making sense of the politics of North Korea. For many years, scientists and philosophers have explored how much human behavior is programmed and how much is actually free will. But now, there's another factor, parasites. Parasites have been found to change animal behaviors, sometimes quite drastically. What does that mean for human behavior? Dixon DePommier is with us. He is a microbiologist, ecologist, and emeritus professor at Columbia University. His books include The Vertical Farm, Feeding the World in the 21st Century, and People, Parasites, and Plowshares, Learning from Our Body's Most Terrifying Invaders. Patrick House also joins us. He's a neuroscientist at Stanford University and the author of a key paper about how one parasite makes rodents lose their fear of cats. Welcome to the two of you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
Dr. DePommier, I would like to start with kind of the basics on the relationship of parasites to animal behavior. I understand parasites feed on their hosts, but sometimes they drive the behaviors of their hosts. What are some examples of this?
Absolutely. There are lots of them. In fact, there are many more to be discovered since we have only recently, I think, come to realize that nature has a series of interlocking behaviors associated with systems that tend to reinforce each other. So parasitism is a system. I don't mean to sound highfalutin on this, but everybody has a basic concept of what an ecosystem is. And if you can imagine all the plants and animals that live within a given region that could be defined as an ecosystem, virtually all those animals and plants that you can see turn out to be what we would call free-living animals or plants. If you look inside them, however, you will find that they have a collection of other organisms. Some of them are good, like the organisms that live inside our intestinal tract, for instance, the bacteria, and some of the viruses as well. But there are other organisms called parasites, which are there to take advantage of these, what we would call successful systems. So in order to do that, of course, these parasites have to be able to get from one host to another. And some of them, not all of them, but some of them alter the behavior of their hosts in order to ensure the fact that they'll be transmitted from one animal or one plant to another. And you asked me for examples. I'll just give you the one that I find the most fascinating, but I'm sure there are tons of them out there. It involves a parasite called Spirometramansinoides. It's a tapeworm. And this tapeworm lives inside the small intestinal tract of cats and other felines like bobcats and panthers and tigers and things of this sort. In order to catch this tapeworm, the cat or feline has to catch another animal and eat it because the parasite has a stage that lives inside the other animal. Well, it turns out that most of these other animals that cats have to catch in order to eat turn out to be either snakes or fish or amphibians. And they're usually pretty fast, especially the amphibians. They tend to jump and hide. You know, they crawl up trees and they escape from their predators, which is the cat. But this particular parasite secretes something, we think we know what it is now, something into its what we would call the host that will give the cat the parasite, in this case a frog, that makes the frog grow uncontrollably so that the frog actually gets bigger and slower and more sluggish, just like we would get if we were to eat too much and become obese. These obese frogs, containing the stage that the cat needs to catch in order to get the tapeworm, become very easy for the cats to catch. And so as a result, the parasite has modified the behavior of the stage of the infection that the cat needs to come in contact with in order to complete the life cycle. Now, that's pretty sophisticated biology, but I mean, it gives you an example of how complicated and how complex life has become through, I would say, billions of years of evolution. There are plenty of other examples like this.
I read about one parasite that actually rewires an ant's brain, its neurons, and then kind of hijacks its body.
That's correct. So that the ant becomes eaten by something else, and then that gives that something else the stage of the parasite that it needs to go on with its life. That's true for a lot of associations that you can find in nature. The more you look for them, the more you find them.
How often do you see this kind of behavior alterations in higher level animals? What about human beings?
I'm not a psychiatrist, nor am I a psychologist. I'm a parasitologist, although in some cases people have mistaken that name and asked me if I was a parapsychologist. So the answer is I'm a parasitologist. And the examples that I could give you from nature's enormous volumes of stories along these lines is the one that I think maybe Patrick House could be better to explain with regards to, I believe you're referring to Toxoplasma gondii, which is a protozoan parasite. And in fact, it's probably the most widely distributed infectious agent on the planet. Not only does it infect all mammals, but it infects most of the cells inside of most mammals. So it's almost a universal parasite. John Boothroyd, who also works at Stanford, he almost is convinced that this, in many cases, is not a parasite, but rather is a symbiont.
And it's rather a what? That, I'm sorry, say that again?
A symbiont.
A symbiont.
That actually helps in some ways to stimulate the immune system and to keep the organisms alive long enough to allow these parasites to be transmitted to other animals over long distances. That becomes a strategy. I mean, a parasite might want to keep its host alive for a long time in order to move away from the source of infection so that other animals can also become infected. So we have these strategies that parasites have evolved as well.
Patrick House, let's bring you in. You have been studying this particular parasite, and one of your findings pertains to how it changes the behavior of rats and makes them more vulnerable to their predators, cats. What happens?
One of the interesting things is that if you actually look at this broad range of parasites that manipulate their host behavior, you actually find most of them in insects. So it'll change the behavior of maybe an ant or maybe a cricket. There are examples of these particular ones. Also, I believe a cockroach. There's one wasp that will actually inject something into a cockroach. But if you think about it, on the level of complexity, these are actually rather simple organisms, insects. I mean, they don't have brains per se as we define them. And what I think makes this particular Toxoplasma parasite interesting is that actually it's one of very few things, if not the only thing that we know of, that actually gets into mammalian brains, sits there, and doesn't actually end up killing the host. This idea that the parasite may actually be sitting in the brain for years, months, kind of across the vast majority of the host's life is interesting, because then you can ask, well, what, if any, possible changes in behavior are there? Because, you know, the brain is the seat of a lot of these, of what we consider to be will. So this particular parasite has to get and can only sexually reproduce. And by sexually, I mean it can only combine its genes around inside the cat. So again, we have cat as an origin for one of the most interesting things in kind of this manipulation hypothesis for parasites. So the parasite is actually stuck in a cat. It has to get from one cat to another cat. How does it do that? It doesn't have legs of its own. And it uses rats and mice and other intermediate hosts to actually ferry itself, to kind of taxi from one cat to the other cat. And what we think is happening is that it's getting into the brain of these rats and somehow making it such that that individual rat is more likely to then get eaten by the cat, which passes on the parasite. And my work has shown, when I looked in the brains of the rats that had this parasite and exposed them to a cat, it actually looked similar to when we took an uninfected animal, uninfected male rat, and exposed it to a female rat. Well, one possibility is that you're making them less afraid of the cat. And another possibility is that you're actually making them attracted to the cat. So what I showed is that maybe there's some hint that what's actually happening is this parasite is making these rats actually attracted to the smell of cats.
Which then makes them prey.
Which then makes them spend more time where cats are, which then makes them more likely to get eaten. I mean, there's a very good reason that rats are, rats and mice alike, anything that a cat, you know, predates, is quite afraid of the smell of a cat because it means imminent doom.
This really does raise the question whether or not we have free will. There's certainly the evolutionary aspect anyway, certain programming, but now we're talking about microorganisms having effect over animal behavior. This particular parasite, Patrick House, that you've been studying is also present in people. What's the scope of the presence and how does it affect people that we know of?
Estimates are maybe a fifth to a third of the world entire world, all 6, 7, I don't know how many there are anymore, 6 or 7 billion people. So it is one of definitely the most common parasites in the world. And you might then ask, if you're getting into numbers that large, at what point we can even really figure out what, if anything, this parasite's doing. So people mostly get it, we believe, through eating raw meat. The parasite ends up in a lot of different animals, a lot of different mammals, including cows, sheep, pigs, goats, everything that we eat. And in countries that seem to eat more raw meat, you tend to get higher infection rates. So France and Brazil, steak tartare, Brazilian barbecues, things like that, you actually have some of the highest rates in the world in these two countries. Another possible route is through cat ownership. So the parasite is actually transmitted through the cat poop. And if you don't clean your litter, or rather, if you clean your litter box well and don't clean your hands well afterwards, people can often ingest it that way. So people do have it. We definitely know that people have it in their brains. And the question is, what, if anything, is it doing? So even if we know that it's changing rat behavior, that gives us no certain indicator that it's changing human behavior, because our brains are, you know, they're similar in some respects, but they're very, very different in many. And one of the interesting things is, well, you have the parasite sitting in a rat brain for maybe a few months, maybe a few years. They don't live very long. But when you have it in a human, and you have it in a human for decades, is it possible that something is coming out, some perturbation is happening that is just very difficult to recognize? So we really don't know. I mean, if you go into a doctor's office and you have toxoplasma, just the parasite, you just test for the parasite and you do have it, you can do a blood test and they'll tell you. That doctor will do nothing special for you. You are not considered sick. There's no, that's not a disease in and of itself. So right now, clinically, there's no consequence to having the parasite.
One of the illnesses that I saw had a correlation with this particular toxoplasma was schizophrenia.
Yes.
Do we know if the correlation means anything yet?
I want to make two caveats to what I just said, which is that it is very dangerous in two cases. One being if you're immunocompromised. So in HIV patients, for example, which is one way that a human can become immunocompromised, toxoplasmosis, which is the actual clinical version, can be fatal. In addition, it can be very, very bad for fetuses. If a pregnant woman picks up the parasite for the first time, the same way that the parasite gets into our brain, it can actually get into the baby's brain. So there are circumstances. I didn't mean to say that it was just a harmless parasite. As to the kind of correlations with mental illness, so this is one of the most, I think, one of the most interesting things about this, and really the reason I'm studying it. And what I would say is that we know, for instance, for just with schizophrenia, that there are people with schizophrenia that do not have this parasite, and there are people with this parasite that do not have schizophrenia. So it's not a one-to-one link. By no means will it turn out. I mean, many, many more people have the parasite in the world, like I said, maybe up to a third, than do schizophrenia. But it's one of these really tricky things where we don't really know what causes schizophrenia to begin with, and we don't really know what this parasite does. So when you're asking about the correlation between the two, you're really asking to kind of make a link between two things we don't know much about. And it's the kind of strongest link that we have out there is maybe around 50, between 50 and 60 studies now have shown that if you have schizophrenia, you're more likely to have this parasite. That's certainly interesting. Like, that's the first nugget of, you know, how scientific hypotheses develop. And now we have to investigate that further. But it's quite likely that actually what could happen, maybe, just as an example, people with schizophrenia tend to have poor hygiene, tend to take less good care of themselves. And that could actually lend to maybe undercooking your meat or not washing your hands, or, you know, you could, schizophrenia can make you more likely to pick up the parasite.
Let me thank you, Patrick House, and let me also thank Dixon DePommier.
Thank you.
When we come back, how do you heal the children abducted and forced into child soldiering or sex slavery? Up next, stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle and the Insider's Insight into Today's Most Pressing Issues. I'm Maria Armudian. What becomes of the children abducted and forced into sex slavery and child soldiering? Our next guest is helping them heal and rebuild their lives. Jane Akaya is a therapist and the founder of Children of Peace Uganda. Welcome, Jane Akaya. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Maria.
Most people know a little bit about what has been going on in Uganda with the Lord's Resistance Army, but they don't know the scope of it and the details of it. Can you give us a sense of how dire the situation was and what it's like today?
The LRA rebellion led by one Joseph Kony started way back in 1988. And I think he felt just dissatisfied with maybe what the government of Uganda was doing. And then he started this rebellion. He felt maybe the leadership should have been based on religious beliefs. And yet Uganda has so many other religions. So for him, he felt that's what he wanted. And yet the reality on the ground is that what he was doing and what he's doing right now does not relate to any religious principles at all. So it started just as a small movement and then it grew so large because initially he would talk to people and people thought, oh, maybe he was a good person. Then eventually when he realized that people were not buying his ideas, were not buying his ideologies, he started abducting children. And he would maybe break into a school and abduct any number of children that he would find in that school, regardless of the age. He would break into people's houses, maybe the whole village in the night. And he takes little children, even as young as 5-year-olds. And he walks them into captivity, into the bushes of northern Uganda. The children really get so enslaved in captivity. The children are trained as child soldiers. The girls are given out as the sex slaves to the commanders. They are also trained as soldiers. The children are definitely forced to do unthinkable things that anyone cannot imagine. They have to walk lots and lots of distance without food, without water. And according to the children that we would receive, a child can go even for 3 days or 5 days without any food and any water. And yet they are carrying lots and lots of luggage. And definitely most of the children died on the way. That went on from 98 up to around 2006. When eventually there was, people tried to negotiate. But even so, there were some peace negotiations that the government tried with the Lord's Resistance Army rebels, but they never really materialized. As a result, according to the World Bank report of 2007, the number of the children and the youth who were abducted in northern Uganda alone is put at 66,000 children.
How many have survived, do you think, of that?
Oh, the ones who have survived and have returned home could be maybe something like 20,000. Only. Yeah, that's a very, very low number compared to the children that got abducted. I have personally worked with children who were forced to kill their parents before they were abducted. I've worked with children who are forced to kill their own siblings. I have worked with children who are, you know, some of the things is just difficult to mention in air. But unthinkable atrocities like forcing children even to eat human flesh. That's how terrible the LRA is. They do things that you cannot imagine another human being would do to another human being, leave alone a child.
Right now, with what you've described in your own website as a relative peace, mm-hmm. are children still at big risk of being abducted like this?
Oh, in northern Uganda right now, no. But even as we know, the LRA, after they tried peace talks, the Juba peace talks in 2007, and, of course, which flopped in 2008-2009 because the LRA was not cooperating. That time, there was a truce that was given to the rebels to cross to Sudan for the peace talks. So the government of Uganda then with other friends helped to block the way. So they are not abducting children in northern Uganda right now. But the abductions are continuing in the DRC, in Congo, and then in the Central African Republic. And that's a great concern for us because we know how much the LRA created a lot of damage in our children in northern Uganda. And we feel the pain because we know what he did in northern Uganda is what is duplicating in the other parts of the countries, in the other countries. And that's so terrible.
So your organization is now working to help these children, and now some of them, I'm sure, are adults, mm-hmm. to heal their own trauma and to rebuild their lives. How many have you worked with so far? How difficult is this task?
Well, the children I personally worked with at the rehabilitation center, the Raquel Rehabilitation Center, were over 3,000 children that we worked with in that center as they returned from the LRA captivity. And then what I personally do now is I set up a nonprofit. Because when the center closed down, the Raquel Center, that was towards the end of 2006, I knew inside my heart that the work that we had done at the center was an emergency kind of response. We usually call it first aid. We had only given the children and the youth first aid. And, you know, an accident victim cannot recover from that. We knew these children could not recover from that. So I personally decided to follow up the children to the communities because we reunited them with their families and others with relatives, those especially
who still had families.
Yeah. So what we are doing right now as Children of Peace Uganda is follow the children to the community, identify their different needs on an individual basis, and see how do we support them, how do we empower them to become self-reliant adults in the near future.
How many have you been personally working with now?
Right now, we have the children who are in our database, they're about 360.
And what are some of the things that you're doing with them? I saw that some of the activities deal with using drama, using art. What is working and what are the results that you're seeing?
We are using a holistic kind of approach because right now, besides the former child soldiers, we have children born in the LRA captivity to these young little mothers. And then we have children also who have lost parents to the LRA. So as Children of Peace Uganda, we've decided to bring all of them together because they are all directly affected. So what do we do with them? We do trauma therapy through creative art. We do drama with them. We do music. We do drawing. And in each activity, we attach a theme. In trauma therapy through art, we've divided it into about three different parts. Number one, we do emotional strength. In the emotional strength, we build their emotional strength to understand that, yes, what they have gone through, they cannot change it, but they can change the future that's ahead of them. They have gone through so much, but they can start all over again and be able to become successful in life. And we tell them that, you know, it's going to be a gradual process and you have to start now to achieve who you want to become in the future. Then the second part of the trauma therapy, we do forgiveness. Because we know that if these children cannot be able to forgive, if they can't reach the point of forgiving those who have hurt them and forgiving themselves, then they cannot get the emotional healing that we are looking for. And we know that once they don't forgive, they hold the bitterness inside them and that can destroy them physically. They will develop physical complications and they will be able to carry, they can carry this forward and hurt other people. So we really emphasize on forgiveness and we tell them it's going to be gradual. So we work on that. The third aspect is we do mentorship. We do what we call leadership mentorship. Our theme is raising peace ambassadors. That's our theme. Because to us, who can tell or who can become a better peace advocate than the person who has gone through unthinkable pain? And he knows that if we didn't have this war, we would have lived maybe a much better life than this. And you know, when you sit with them in our sessions and we ask them, whom do you want to become? They will tell you, I want to become a member of parliament. I want to be able to have policies, functional policies that protect children. I don't want another child to go through what I have gone through. To us, that is so much. So we know that we are mentoring young people who are going to become leaders, not only in Northern Uganda, but that will affect the whole world in one way or the other. Some of them are going to be working with the UN in the near future. Some of them are going to be working maybe in some great radio stations like here, and they will be able to talk to people, the value of peace. They will be able to tell people that, yes, we have differences in our ideologies, but you know what? We can sit down and resolve this issue. We don't need the gun. The gun has torn us down. We can still go back to the old times when we sit down and solve issues on a round table. So we see that so much in these children. The second project that we do is education scholarships. Because we know without an education, it's almost next to impossible to realize an development in the life of an individual and then in the general community. And then most of these children, you find maybe a child was a former child soldier, is also an orphan. So if somebody does not step into their lives to support them go to school, then what becomes of them? They would keep thinking, if my father was there, if my mother was there, I would have also gone to school. And yet I know all of us, if we came together, just the little contribution from each one of us will make these children go to school and tomorrow they will become very responsible adults somewhere. Then we have water. We're trying to partner with some organizations like the Tiva Water. It's an American-based organization that does water filters. And these water filters, definitely we give out to households, especially where these children come from. The children that we work with, the youth that we work with. You might find in a household, there's this little girl called Dilis. Dilis was abducted at the age of 8. That same night, her father was killed by the rebels. The mother was killed. They were abducted all together, and then she lost also two brothers to the LRA. She ended up getting abducted. She stayed in captivity and managed to escape. And when she comes back home, there are three little siblings she has to take care of. Today, she's 15 years old, but she's taking care of her three little siblings. They are just alone in their home. She's the head of the household. So if we're not going to step in the life of such children, what becomes of them? We give them this water filter. That means safe and clean water, which is very, very vital for their health. And a water filter costs $60. And you're giving clean water to this family for the next 7 to 10 years for $60. You really see the results. They talk about it, how it has helped them. The children are no longer falling sick from worms and all this. The fourth one is we're looking at socioeconomic empowerment. Because we have these child mothers who have returned from captivity with the children. A girl is abducted at the age of 8 years. She's in captivity for 10 years or more. She has come back with four children born in captivity. She has not been empowered through education because she lost all the childhood, and she's here to take care of four children.
She's alone.
And she's alone.
Has no partner.
Uh-huh. And then, of course, they also still have, there's so much stigma attached to this, coming back with these children, because the community is not accepting them yet fully.
The children or the...
The children.
The young women.
The children that the young girls have come back with, because they feel these are children to these rebel commanders who have made us suffer so much. This is a child to Kony, because I work with girls who were given out as sex slaves to Joseph Kony himself, and they have children with him, very little nice children, and I love all of them, each one of them.
And these young girls must love their children.
Yeah, and some of them honestly don't accept the children, but we teach them to love the children. How do we do this? We tell them that no single human being on this planet chooses a parent. I did not choose my mother. I didn't choose my father. Neither did you, neither did anyone on this planet. This is something that you wake up one morning and you know that's your father and that's your mother and that is it. We can't change this. And that's exactly what has happened to these children. Whether the biological father is Joseph Kony, whether he's a prominent person in America or in Uganda, they are children. They are very nice children like any other child. They are human beings like any other person. So we are not going to stigmatize somebody because of his parents, background, or anything. We are looking at children. They are all children, just like any child in your house, any child in your school. That is it. So we teach them slowly. And that's exactly what we are beginning to do. Our next step is have maybe some funds where we can do a radio program locally to be able to talk to the community. We want them to understand under what circumstances were these children born.
So Jane Akayu, you have become a counselor and taken this on yourself. What led you to build this project?
I have a training as a teacher. I was born and raised in Uganda. I also trained in gender and development. I did a lot of training, short trainings on trauma management. I also did a degree in democracy and development. And then right now I'm doing another course.
And this was all in Uganda?
All in Uganda. What has also helped is directly working with these children as they return. You get the experience, like each day you learn something different as you work with this child. We try to employ different methods in working with them, and some of them don't work. And then another one is working for this child. And each time, like, you know, you are learning something as you work with them. So the experience itself in working with them has taught me so much and has humbled me so much.
Thank you very much, Jane Akayu, both for your work and for coming here to talk with us and share it with us and our listeners.
Well, thank you so much.
When we come back, making sense of the politics of North Korea. Stay tuned.
From the pulpit, a general raised his hand, preaching violence against Islam. And so his Christian soldiers marched on, through his killing field, in the name of his God. But thou shalt not kill, let the war be done, let the peace be won. Let the war be done, let the peace be won now.
Hello, I'm Maria Armudian, and this is the Scholar Circle. Tensions have once again escalated between North Korea and the U.S. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un announced again an end to its armistice with South Korea and threatened a preemptive strike against the U.S. What are the realities of the politics of North Korea? And what is the proper response of the United States and the international community? Stephen Haggard is with us. He is professor at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. He's also the co-author of Famine in North Korea and Witness to Transformation, Refugee Insights into North Korea. He also co-edits a blog about North Korea. Jacques Hymans also joins us. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and the author of The Psychology of Nuclear Proliferation, Identity, Emotions, and Foreign Policy, and Achieving Nuclear Ambitions, Scientists, Politicians, and Proliferation. Charles Armstrong is also with us. He is professor of Korean studies and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy in the State, and the forthcoming Tyranny of the Week, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with a historical context for the current state of affairs with North Korea. Charles Armstrong, let's start with you. What do you think we need to know about the past to understand the current situation?
Well, I think the most important thing to know is that we've been, in a sense, in a state of war with North Korea for 63 years. The Korean War, which went from 1950 to 53, ended in an armistice, and Kim Jong-un has been good enough in the last few weeks to remind us of the armistice by saying that it was now nullified, which means there was never a peace treaty, there was never a formal end to the war. So that's one context, 60 years of this confrontation between the U.S. and North Korea. The other thing to remember is that this sort of belligerence and bluster from North Korea is a recurrent theme and especially reaches peaks during the U.S.-South Korean joint military exercises, going back to 1976, the first so-called Team Spirit exercise. And we happen to be in one of those joint exercise patterns right now, and this is another reason that North Korea has really ratcheted up the rhetoric, although it has to be said, I don't think any of us have seen the rhetoric ratcheted up quite this high yet. And the third thing to remember is that we've had a confrontation with North Korea specifically over their nuclear weapons program for almost 20 years, since 1994, when we came very close to what appears to have been a serious military confrontation and a contemplation of a preemptive strike on North Korea's nuclear facilities. So what's happened now is those three things have come together. The 60th anniversary of the armistice, the reaction to U.S.-South Korean military exercises, and the sanctions that the U.N. has put on North Korea after the nuclear test of February. And finally, we have a new leader in North Korea who seems to really want to show us and his own people that he means business and he can talk tougher than any of his predecessors.
Well, we're going to want to talk about each of those things a little bit more in depth. Stephen Haggard, let's bring you in now. What else do you think we really need to know about the history of this relationship, the history of North Korea, South Korea, that really will help us to make sense of all this?
Let me just endorse the things that Charles has said. I think the background of the unsettled war, the fact that we only have an armistice, this is a particularly important background condition because one of the questions looking forward is how we might resolve that state of war, whether it's possible to get back to negotiations, and I think that's something which is hanging over all of the escalatory rhetoric. The two other things I would add have to do with a little bit more of the recent history. The onset of the current nuclear crisis is around the fall of 2002, so we've had about a decade when we've had a kind of heightened tension over North Korea's nuclear ambitions. And that's resulted in a succession of nuclear tests, one in 2006, another in 2009, and most recently in early 2013. And in the wake of each of those, the United States has been able to orchestrate a set of UN Security Council resolutions imposing various sanctions on North Korea. And China has been a key player in those negotiations because the Security Council allows any of the P5 countries to veto such resolutions, which means basically we have to negotiate something that the Chinese can live with. And we've seen a bit of a stepping up of pressure on the part of China. I mean, they're still not willing to really use the full leverage they have over North Korea, but they seem to be willing to impose somewhat more costs on North Korea than they have in the past.
Jacques Hymans.
I think it might be interesting for your listeners to hear a little bit about the world context of nuclear proliferation over the decades and how North Korea fits into that. I also endorse what my previous two colleagues have said. On the world stage, North Korea actually started working on nuclear weapons, we believe, all the way back in the 1960s. The evidence coming out of Eastern European archives after the end of the Cold War, those Eastern European states had good relations with North Korea, and so they were able to get a little bit more of an inside view than most Western states could have. And the North Koreans were pretty explicit already back in the 1960s that they were trying to build nuclear weapons. So they've been pretty constantly at this work for a half century now. And yet, the world sort of has moved on. In the 60s, it wasn't all that uncommon for states to be trying to launch nuclear weapons programs. But over time, thanks in part to changes in the way that states think about themselves and think about power in the world, and thanks in part to particular non-proliferation measures such as the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which came into force in 1970, essentially states have moved away from seeking nuclear weapons as a prime element of their international security postures. And so today, really, we only have two states that are even widely suspected of seeking nuclear weapons. They don't have them already, one being North Korea and the other being Iran. And even in the case of Iran, there's a lot of question marks about their ultimate intentions. So North Korea is really sticking out like a sore thumb in the international context today in terms of its pursuit of nuclear weapons.
You bring up another aspect of this, which is they're sticking out like a sore thumb. Everybody else is starting to phase out their nuclear weapons. What does it mean with this new leader pursuing nuclear weapons? Some people have called him crazy. Stefan Haggard, you've mentioned that you don't think he's crazy. What about the psychology of the new leader? What do we know of him?
Well, we don't know that much, really. First of all, he's young, so that's an interesting thing to take into account. He's 28 years old or so. He was schooled in Switzerland. We're not sure that really makes any difference. But you have to look at a system like this not in terms of just the personalities, though those can be important, but in terms of a kind of coalition of political actors that are running a regime of this sort. This is clearly a very closed system. I think your listeners all know that it has one of the worst records with respect to human rights and civil liberties. It's obviously an autocracy, but it's particularly narrow in its composition. And the military has come to play a very central role in both the support for the top family leadership and also in the legitimation strategy of the regime. In the 90s, Kim Jong-il, Kim Jong-un's father, had to assume power following the death of his father in 1994, and he didn't have military credentials and very quickly turned to the military to get himself through an extremely difficult period, including a famine that killed somewhere between 600,000 and a million North Koreans. So the military is very deeply implicated in the political structure of North Korea, and I think that's influencing some of what we're seeing today as well.
Charles Armstrong here. I agree with Steph's analysis of this. But North Korea has put a lot of investment, both political and, of course, economic, into the development of nuclear weapons, in part because they don't have much else. They have a very weak economy, one of the poorest countries in the world. They've had great many difficulties over the last couple of decades, and yet they've insisted that they will be a powerful and prosperous nation. And so increasingly over time, they have, it seems, made the choice that nuclear weapons are the way to go. They are a relatively economical defense. They see this as a deterrence against a hostile United States. And over the last 20 years of the confrontation between the U.S. and the other members of the international community and North Korea over the North's nuclear weapons program, it's become more and more evident, until now it's become completely out in the open, that North Korea is not intending to give up its nuclear weapons. They've said that a number of times explicitly, and that puts us in a real dilemma because clearly the U.S. and other countries do not find that acceptable. I want to add one more thing. South Korea also had a very vigorous nuclear weapons development program in the 1970s. It was finally put to a stop under intense pressure from the United States, But this is also something that North Korea has been, in a way, reacting to. And one of the more interesting polls taken in the last few months in South Korea, actually two separate polls gave the same result. The majority, perhaps as many as two-thirds of South Koreans, are now saying they should have their own nuclear deterrent. So the danger we face is not just North Korea having nuclear weapons, but the possibility of other countries in the region wanting to develop a nuclear deterrent or a nuclear arsenal as well.
Jacques Hymans, you've pointed out that North Korea has been failing at its efforts of building nuclear weapons, but you also say that it has not merely been acting out. Do you agree with your colleagues on this?
I agree in part with my colleagues, and perhaps I would place a little bit of a different emphasis on some factors than in their comments here. First of all, in terms of who is actually driving this program forward, I obviously do not know the internal politics of inside the regime, how strong Kim Jong-un may have been, you know, immediately upon receiving the crown. But my impression of the North Korean regime is that the family leadership that Steph mentioned really is at the very pinnacle here. And we should not view the military as some sort of alternative structure to the civilian political leaders. The civilian leaders definitely control the military. They are able to replace top military leaders seemingly at will. Kim Jong-un has replaced some top leaders. So I don't think it's entirely right to portray this as a kind of a tug of war. The family is in charge, and as Steph very rightly says, it's a very, very small group of people who are intensely committed to retaining their control. So I do think that if not Kim Jong-un as an individual, certainly a very small group of individuals are making decisions about this. And this has important consequences because in sort of modern states, people at the top are able to take advantage of a large amount of thinking and planning and legwork that is being done for them by professionals who are working for the state. But in North Korea, the people underneath the guys at the top are really afraid of the guys at the top and not able to apply kind of professional training to writing the course of policy and putting it in a direction that would be, let's say, sensible. So in a sense, I do endorse to some extent the sort of journalistic talk about the North Korean regime is crazy, not in the sense that the top family members that are running the state are clinically insane, but rather in the sense that the information that they are dealing with is certainly far inferior to the information that is at the fingertips of most other modern state leaders.
You're saying if they had that professional guidance, that perhaps it wouldn't be escalating quite like this.
It's much more possible that in this situation of tension and crisis that there is miscalculation around the corner, which might be lower possibility in the event that these people had better professional advice around them. I might also add, just on the issue of the North Korean desire for nuclear weapons, that at least in my research, I have found that that desire has actually been quite constant over the years, and I would not place a lot of stress on this or that external carrot or stick that might have been proffered to North Korea. This has really been a core element of North Korean international identity, really, very long before the end of the Cold War, for instance. And I don't think that we would expect at this stage, or even 10 years ago, that this or that carrot or stick would have, you know, caused them to deviate fundamentally from their path. Of course, carrots and sticks could and were used to decrease tensions at some point or increase tensions, but in terms of causing them to deviate from their strategic objective of having a nuclear weapons arsenal, basically I think that that was not possible already from the start.
Charles Armstrong?
I'm not sure I agree with that. First of all, they did freeze their plutonium program for 8 years after the agreed framework of October of 1994. So it may be the case that nuclear weapons acquisition has been an important part of their strategy, but it's also a matter of degree. It may be they could not be cajoled or incentivized to eliminate their nuclear arsenal altogether, but I think there have been means that have sometimes been reasonably successful to get them to at least freeze or slow down their program. And
Jacques, quickly, I don't want to say that I disagree with that. I want to endorse that. As I mentioned, carrots and sticks have been used in the past to decrease tensions.
Right, but what I'm saying is that the way they talk to the world about their nuclear weapons now is different from the past. They actually threatened the U.S. with a nuclear strike, which I don't think we need to take seriously, but they really have made it much more a central part of their posture against the outside world.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we are talking about the dynamics with North Korea. Is there a benefit to North Korea to keep the tensions heightened like this? Is there a domestic benefit to this? Charles Armstrong, you had written a bit about this. Do you think that's the case?
Yes, and I think Steph Haggard would have a few things to say about this as well. But very briefly, it is important to keep tensions at a certain level to keep the society mobilized and to keep the focus on the leadership. So I think there is a domestic element to this, but I'm not sure that the North Korean leadership wants to push things this far because it is a huge drain on them economically to mobilize their military, to move missiles around and so on. So yes, I think there is a sense in which the leadership needs an enemy to keep the country's focus and to mobilize the citizens behind the leader. And this has been the case for over 60 years.
I often wonder if that's the case in most political leaderships. Stephen Haggard, I think you've been prompted to come in on this.
Okay. Let me go back to something that Jacques said. And again, partly sharpening differences where they may be not quite as sharp as I'm making them. But Jacques is right that the top leadership has purged elements of the military following the transition to Kim Jong-un. And if you look back before the death of Kim Jong-il in December of 2011, there was clearly an attempt on Kim Jong-un's father's part to put in place a set of military and civilian party and family leaders who could support the transition. And what we saw is that after Kim Jong-un came to power, he did in fact purge some of those military leaders, but at the same time he promoted his own military people into positions of authority. And we see that bodies like the Politburo, the National Defense Commission, even the Secretariat, which is an administrative apparatus of the party, see this big influx of military personnel. So I do think this still has to be understood as a regime in which the military plays a role, not so much a decision-making role, but it's a component of the key coalition or core coalition of the state. But the other thing is that the military has become a kind of symbol, a trope almost, for the whole country. And when the father, Kim Jong-il, came to office, he launched a political line, I think you would call it, which is military-first politics. And the meaning of military-first politics is very complicated, but one component of it is that the whole society should see itself as exercising and following a kind of military-style discipline in support of the leadership and the objectives of the leadership. And the military, rather than the working class, for example, under a traditional Marxist interpretation, is in some ways the leading force of the revolution. And so the nuclear program and the space program, which we haven't talked about, and I take the space program as being a euphemism for the missile program, have really become very important tools of domestic legitimation for the regime. They're on billboards, they're on the news, you know, they're taught in the schools, in study circles, and so forth. These are achievements of this regime and this leadership, which I think have become important pieces of the new leader's domestic position.
Let's turn to the U.S.'s response and the international community's response to North Korea. Jacques Hymans, let's bring you in for this first. How would you assess the U.S.'s response, the international community's response, and how would you contrast that with how you think we should be responding?
At least in this current crisis, the U.S. has reacted with a lot of probity and restraint. Of course, as Charles mentioned earlier, there are South Korean-U.S. joint military exercises that always anger the North Koreans. And so in that sense, the U.S. can be said to have teed up the conditions for this current crisis. But with the crisis spiraling as it has, the U.S. has not added fuel to the fire. I really give the Obama administration very high marks for how they have reacted. And this also goes for the vast majority of the states in the international community, which basically have North Korea know that they really are taking things too far and they need to cool it.
Stephen Haggard, would you agree?
I guess I'm a little bit more critical. I think it was very important to show the flag on the part of both the South Koreans and the United States that the deterrent was there. Because what we don't want is we don't want the North Koreans miscalculating and probing either along the border or particularly out at sea along what's called the northern limit line. And that's it's actually in the maritime sphere where a lot of the probes in action have taken place. So I think showing that deterrent and so forth. But I think the stationing of new interceptors in Alaska and Guam, the bombing over flights, the U.S. rhetoric on the nuclear capacity of our bomber fleet and so forth, I think it's time to kind of stand down from that. The point has been made. And I don't think we're interested in continuing to wave that stick. But let me raise one other important point we haven't discussed, and that's the role of China in this. Because China, as both Jack and Charles well know, they've both written on this, China's really a key player because North Korea is increasingly dependent on China. The sanctions that the international community have imposed on North Korea have essentially made North Korea more, not less, dependent on Chinese trade and investment. And so the geopolitics of the region and how we're going to get back to negotiations, if we do, is going to have to go through Beijing making some strategic decisions about how much pressure it's going to place on North Korea.
Charles Armstrong, please respond to that relationship between China and North Korea and other actors that you think are important, how they're evolving and how they might play out.
I would give the Obama administration pretty low marks for their policy toward Korea in general, which has been characterized mostly by neglect rather than really paying attention to the issue. And ignoring North Korea is certainly not going to make it go away. And yes, it is important to, as Steph has said, to show the flag, to demonstrate to our allies especially, as well as to North Korea, that the U.S. will stand up to provocation. But it also brings about the danger of adding fuel to the fire. When the U.S. does bring in nuclear submarines, advanced fighters, and go on bombing dummy raids and so forth, it elicits a predictable response of North Korea, raising the stakes and ratcheting up the rhetoric and actions even higher. So we do have to think about a way out of this and to seriously consider how we will resolve this issue short of a military confrontation. And this brings us to negotiation, which of course also brings us to China. I don't know if the six-party talks that were suspended in 2009 are the way to go, but there needs to be some sort of forum in which the parties directly involved in this, particularly the U.S., North and South Korea, and China, but perhaps Japan and even Russia as well, can figure out a way, sit down and talk with each other to prevent this sort of thing from happening, and not merely to contain North Korea, but to allow it a way to enter into a region in a more productive manner. China is in an interesting position. It has signed on to the sanctions. It's talked tougher than it has in the past, but it's not clear that they're much more willing to do anything more than they had before to enforce sanctions. They still are not willing to risk destabilization of their neighbor, and they don't want to push North Korea too far. At the end of the day, the Chinese say, and I think there's some truth to it, they cannot tell the North Koreans what to do. North Koreans are tough customers and have always been so, even at the peak of their alliance with China. So we have to find, as difficult as it is to imagine now, a way to negotiate a solution to this problem that involves North Korea, China, and South Korea at a minimum.
And in terms of the sanctions, do you think we should change our policy with that?
The sanctions are there. The lifting of sanctions should be an incentive to North Korea if it does certain things and moves in a direction that is beneficial to others around it. But ultimately, there has to be, as much as I hate to use this expression, carrots as well as sticks.
Right. an age-old expression that still kind of works. Let me just do a quick check if anybody feels they have something they must say, Jacques Hymans.
Just briefly, it seems to me that the test of the American, the kind of correctness or the success of the American policy is precisely whether or not this situation in North Korea is bringing us closer with China or farther away from China. And it seems to me quite clear that the North Korean actions and the American response, which I view as measured and correct, have been bringing China and America closer together rather than driving them apart as the North Koreans would prefer. So that's one of the main reasons why I view the American response as having really been proper.
Stephen Haggard?
I think there are two dilemmas of U.S. policy, and they can be stated fairly briefly. One is that we simultaneously have to send signals of deterrence at the same time that we're leaving a door open for negotiations. And those two policies are kind of in contradiction from the North Korean perspective, because they see sanctions, they see deterrence, and at the same time, we have sent signals of a willingness to negotiate. And second, we have to leave the door open to negotiations, even though it's becoming increasingly clear, to me at least, that the North Koreans actually have very little interest in negotiating. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Obama administration has not invested a lot of resources in North Korea, because there's just not much return to be had from doing so.
We'll leave it there then. Thank you, Charles Armstrong, Stephen Haggard, Jacques Hymans. Great to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Stephen Haggard is professor at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California, San Diego. He's a co-author of Famine in North Korea. He also co-edits a blog about North Korea. Jacques Hymans is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and the author of The Psychology of Nuclear Proliferation, Identity, Emotions, and Foreign Policy. Charles Armstrong is professor of Korean studies and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The Koreas and the forthcoming Tyranny of the Week, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chiprinankine Agassian and Leonardo Alanis, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes and follow us on Twitter at armudian.
Let the war be done. Let the peace be won. Let the war be done. Let the peace be won now.